Two.
Okay, this is talk three in the series on that we're doing on assurance and perseverance. And so, what we're going to do now is look at the assurance and warning passages and the fact that they're aimed at different character types, because the point is that you may look at these things and say, why has God put all these apparently contradictory passages in the Bible? Why are they both there? And the answer is really that they're aimed at different people. So you've got one set of passages aimed at one group and one set of passages aimed at another group. Both are true, but different groups need to focus on the one or the other because of the way they are. Mm. And so the assurance passages are aimed primarily at the sort of sincere, earnest, anxious, God-fearing, repentant, honest, tender-hearted person. He's got no intention of neglecting or despising or throwing away his salvation. He's not wanting that or intending that in any way. He's just wanting reassurance that his salvation will not be taken away from him by other people or by God or by circumstances. Well, then what about the warning passages? The warning passages are generally directed towards the people who are glib, complacent, careless, presumptuous, overconfident, self-reliant, self-righteous, carnal, insincere, shallow, worldly, and so on. Now, people who are like that, they need the warning passages. So both sets of passages are true. It's just that different groups particularly need them. So I'm reminded of when my wife was doing it at school. In her house, she had a sister who was very different from her. So her mum was saying to my wife, you need to study less and go out more. But she was saying at the very same time to her sister, you need to study more and go out less. Now the same person was making directly opposite statements in the same house. Now how could they both be true? Well, they were true because each of the people concerned had a different temperament, priorities, different nature, different habits. So the one person needed to be told to study more and less of the socializing. The other person needed to be told, study a bit less and you need to get out and have a bit of time off. Now, both are true, but they're true for different people. And so, depending on the nature of the person concerned. So really, when both of these types of passage are needed, both are true, but they're particularly needed by different character types. And so the Bible is telling us, therefore, that there is a way to throw away our own salvation. We can throw it away, but we do so in particular by our neglect, because the throwing away of salvation is very rarely, if ever, done in an instant. It's never the choice of an immediate choice. It's never an immediate situation where you go from all to nothing. The throwing away of salvation is almost always the culmination of a long series of small choices, each of which seemed insignificant at the time. And those little decisions cause you to move a little bit more and a little bit more away from God. And so each sinful choice makes your heart get that little bit harder and colder. And this is the way it happens. That's the way that we do it. Not by just an immediate once off. So the warning passages are telling you, don't go down that route at all. Don't go anywhere down that road. Don't get cold at all. Don't get hard. Don't even make small decisions to get hard-hearted. Don't make small steps in the wrong direction. And then you won't go down that way. And so, we need to have a balanced understanding of the assurance passages and the warning passages, and we need to believe them both at the same time. Because various writers and various people in churches argue passionately in favour of one or the other, because they focus 100% on assurance or 100% on warning. And that's why if you've been in churches for any length of time, you'll have come across people who will weigh you up on this question of whether you are you once saved, always saved? And they want to know, are you for once saved, always saved? And if you are, they either absolutely approve of you or they absolutely deplore you for being that. And so this is one of these sort of litmus tests that people use in churches to weigh you up. And if they're doing that because they are either utterly committed to the assurance passages, or they have a kind of almost a suspicion of the assurance passages. So if you're a once saved, always saved type person, you are effectively putting to one side the warning passages because you don't believe in them, don't like them, don't want them, etc. But you can make the mistake also of being entirely fixated upon the warning passages, where for you assurance just doesn't mean anything, doesn't exist even. There's no such thing as assurance. And what I'm trying to say is that both are right and both are true. The assurance the Bible gives is valid and meaningful. It really, really, really means something. It really is there. But also the warnings are really there. So you can't adopt this either-or stance, which so many do. You're into the once saved, always saved, and that's almost like a badge of honour that you believe in that. And then not only will you not accept any passages which contradict you, you won't accept any people who contradict you. You don't want to be with anybody who doesn't agree with you about once saved, always saved. Or, if you're on the other camp, you don't want to be with anybody who believes in once saved, always saved, because, you know, you find that reprehensible and deplorable. Now, I wish that was an exceptional thing that you hardly ever see, but in fact you see it quite a lot. And it's almost like you're judged on whether you say Derry or Londonderry. You know, people are weighing you up. What are you based on what you say on these things? Which camp are you in? But what we need is to be balanced and hold both passages, both types of passage in our minds, and accept both and believe both and to pay attention to both and rely on both at the same time. So let's try and look at how we can summarise what that balance is. What is this balance that we're speaking of? And how can we make sense of it? Well, let's go through it step by step. Now, firstly, point one, we are held on to by God's faithfulness. So this is an aspect of the assurance passages. We are held on to. So he's holding on to us with a steady grip. Now, he is reliable. He can be trusted. He'll never abandon you. He'll never forget you. He'll never do any of those things. He'll never forsake you. Therefore, if you're an anxious person, you can be reassured, because he won't do any of those things. Now, you might do those things, but he won't do those things. This is the point. So let me give you an illustration that came once, something that happened with our dog, our Border Terrier. Once we were out on a walk, and we had to cross over a very high, very narrow footbridge. And this little it was made of metal, but it had gaps on either side. Quite big gaps, actually. Not big enough for a human, an adult, to get through. But if you were very small, you could fall through these gaps. And our dog was walking along with us. And the dog was frightened and was cowering and trembling, because it could see the gaps on either side, and it was afraid of falling off of this bridge. So the dog was afraid that it would fall off the bridge. So what I did when I saw her trembling, I picked the dog up and carried her across the bridge. And when I did that, it was like all the fear just drained out of her. She stopped trembling. She was quite relaxed with me carrying her across a bridge. The holes in the bridge were still there, but when I was carrying her across the bridge, she felt quite relaxed. Why was that? She had total faith in me to hold on to her, but she didn't have total faith in herself to stay across that, get across that bridge without falling through these holes. But she had total faith I wouldn't let her fall through those holes. Do you see? Now, how did our dog know this? Because she'd heard me preaching on this subject. She knew that God is totally faithful and won't drop you. You could drop yourself, however. Now, she understood that she could fall through these holes, but she had total confidence in me not to let that happen. So that's the kind of thing that we mean by assurance. We have assurance of his faithfulness. Okay. So point two, whilst ever we are sincere and remain in him and continue to put our trust in him, God will never reject us. So he won't reject us even when we make mistakes, or even when we aren't as good as other people, or when we aren't as impressive as someone, or we don't know things that other people know, or we just make blunders, or even when we sin, or even when we do wrong things. Those things in themselves won't cause God to reject us. He'll never reject us while we continue to be sincere and remain in him and put our trust in him. It's because he doesn't judge us by observable results. He doesn't judge us by the amount we achieve or so forth. He's judging us by our heart motives. So if we're sincere and remain in him and put our trust in him, he will never reject us, even when we make mistakes. So there's another basis for our assurance. Number three, we can have a real and meaningful assurance right now that when we die, we will have eternal life. We will not face God's wrath. We will not go to the great white throne judgment or the lake of fire. So right now, you can really and genuinely have that assurance, if you are a sincere person and you really mean what you're saying. That assurance is real right now. And I'll give some more illustrations shortly to explain that further. So point four. However, here's where the howevers come in. If we then take God for granted and lose respect for him and cease to honour him and stop loving him and drift away from him, then it is possible that our names will be blotted out of the book of life. We will then lose our place in the body of Christ and lose our salvation. So we've just been saying that he'll never reject us, he'll never drop us, he won't let us down, we can rely on him. We're saying, but if we lose respect, if we cease to honour, then we can effectively separate ourselves from him, and our names will then be blotted out of the book of life. Five, if that happens, then when we die, we would not be counted as part of the church. We'd be counted as part of the unbelieving world, and we'd be judged with the unbelievers at the great white throne. And that is why it is perfectly scriptural and proper to say that there are some people who are in the church now who won't be in the church at the end. There are some people who are believers now who won't be believers in the end. And that's the frightening thing. And I'm going to try to clarify even further as we go along how I can simultaneously say that and still say that we have assurance. And I hope that will become clearer. So then, next point, six. If that happened, then the judgment upon us, if we did go to the great white throne, would be even more severe than for a person who had never believed. So the judgment on a person who has believed and fallen away is more severe than that on a person who never knew, never believed, never was saved. That, I think, we can say categorically, especially from the letter to the Hebrews. Point seven. If our name is eventually removed from the book of life, and if we lose our salvation, it would not really be something that God has done to us. It would be more accurate to say it's something we've done to ourselves. It would be like our dog jumping out of my arms when I'm carrying her across the bridge and just deciding to jump out of my arms. Do you see? Whilst I was carrying her across the bridge, everything was safe. I was totally reliable. I was trustworthy. I would never have thrown her from that bridge. Never, never, never. But if she just jumped out of my arms, she could have fallen from the bridge. Do you see? But if she didn't jump out of my arms, she would never have fallen from that bridge. So if we jump out, it's because we did it. If we lose our salvation, it's because we did it. It's not something God did. It's not something someone else did. It's something we did. But moreover, almost always it's the end product of a steady long-term process of decay. So when a person falls away, they're like a rotten old tree that falls over in a sudden wind. That tree was rotting for decades, probably years at least, and the insides of that tree had rotted away, perhaps were hollow. And then a big wind comes, a 90 mile an hour wind, and over it goes. And if you then look on at the tree when it falls over, and you'll see there's a great chasm inside it where all its innards have just rotted away. And that was going on for years, and you perhaps couldn't see it because on the outside the tree looked like it was all right, but it was rotting away. So let me give you another analogy now, a longer one, to try to get hold of this thing. How do we hold these passages in our minds at the same time? What we're trying to address, because this is so confusing to so many, is how can we say meaningfully that we have assurance and at the same time that we need to persevere? So how can you simultaneously say that God is assuring you that you have eternal life, but at the same time telling us not to throw it away, not to abandon it? Okay. So this is an analogy that I think God gave me, and I think it's helpful. But if you imagine a chap called George Cadbury, you may have heard of him. At least you'll have heard of Cadbury's, the chocolate people. Now, George Cadbury was, I think, the son of the founder, and he was the one that made the company big. So in the 19th century, he built this huge chocolate business, and he was a Christian, and he had extremely advanced and compassionate attitudes towards staff conditions and working conditions and working relations and so on. So when you went to work for Cadbury's, unlike anybody else you might go to work for, if you went to Cadbury's, you got all sorts of benefits, like your children were put into schools, there were medical clinics, he gave homes to his staff to live in, he built houses for the staff at Bourneville, and they all had these rows of houses which for the time were very posh, and you had a garden and so forth. And then also, when you retired from working for George Cadbury, you stayed in your cottage until you died. You never lost the cottage. So when you went to work for George Cadbury, he basically would promise you that you have a job for life. He would say basically, if you come to work at Cadbury's, you'll have a job for life, and when you're too old or too sick to work any longer, you also have my promise of a cottage for life. Therefore, you can continue to live on in your home even when you retire. Now, there's George Cadbury's promise. So, let's look at this along the same lines of God's promise and also God's warnings. So, that promise from Cadbury's is entirely valid and meaningful. That employee who goes to work for him, that really means something to them, doesn't it? It's not nothing, it's something. There you are, you've got a job at Cadbury's, you're absolutely set up, you're set up for life. You really are. The promise of George Cadbury is unbreakable. He is totally trustworthy. Nobody's going to get George Cadbury to tell a lie or break a promise or be vindictive or be malicious or do anything nasty. That's not going to happen. When he says a thing, he means it. He can be totally trusted. So there's no question of George Cadbury letting you down or failing you or not honouring his promises to you. It's a cast iron promise. And therefore you can have assurance that you're going to have that job, that you're going to have that cottage, that you're going to get medical attention when you're old. He's not going to throw you out of that house when you get into your 70s and give it to a younger worker. You've got assurance. Okay. Now then, look at the other side of the coin. You've got that assurance. It would mean something to a sincere person. But what if you turn it round? What if we left George Cadbury? What if we rejected him? What if we turned away from him? So imagine a worker goes to work for Cadbury's, and after a time, after a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, they become complacent, ungrateful, hard-hearted, resentful, indifferent. They begin to work badly, they begin to behave badly at the factory. Imagine they're regularly late for work. They become lazy, unproductive, disrespectful, disobedient. They neglect their duties. Imagine they go even further. They steal from the company. They intentionally cause damage to company property. Now, what would George Cadbury do then? I mean, he's at the top of the company. He's right at the top. But imagine, what would him and those who work for him do to you then, if you did those things? Well, first of all, his wish would be for you to be given warnings. He'd tell the supervisors to give you warnings about your attitude, your performance, your conduct. He would even give repeated warnings with increased seriousness and intensity. But in the end of the end, if you kept on doing it, there would reach a point where you could not blame him if George Cadbury said something along these lines. If he said, your repeated neglect and misconduct and your indifference to your duties have made you an unfruitful, unproductive employee. You are not fit to remain in employment here. Therefore, I'm dismissing you from the company. Okay. Now, who brought that about? Did George Cadbury bring that about, or did you bring it about? Obviously you did. And the question is, how could he realistically do anything other than that? How could he just let you do whatever you want without limit? Anything you want. Now, have you ever heard the way that once saved, always saved camp speaks? They really do insist that you can do anything you want, anything at all, anything at all. You can burn down an orphanage, you can rampage through the streets killing old ladies. You can do anything you want and you're not going to lose your salvation. Now, this is a point of absolute doctrine and dogma to people who hold this view. And if you in any way call that into doubt, this will really cause a rift with such a person, because it's a real stumbling block. And they hold on to this absolute belief in total, unequivocal, unambiguous, once saved, always saved, nothing at all can ever change it. But what would George Cadbury say? He would allow a certain period of time to go by, he'd allow so many warnings, probably more warnings than he ought to give, probably more time than he ought to allow. But eventually a point would be reached where he would say, that's it. You've got to go. And that's the point. So he hasn't broken his word. Could you turn around to George Cadbury and say, you said to me that I had a job for life and a cottage for life. That was your promise to me. How could you say that to George Cadbury? You've just been late for work 17 times. You've done this, you've done that, you've had so many warnings and you've been... You could not turn around and say it to him. Now, his promise to you has never been broken. All his assurances were totally sincere and genuine, meaningful, and he kept all of them. It was you that didn't keep them, not him. Do you see? So take the analogy even further. Imagine the worker at Cadbury's chooses of their own free will to leave the job. So we're moving on. We're not talking any longer about misconduct or unfruitfulness. You actually leave Cadbury's, you leave the job, you leave the cottage, and you go away and work for another company. Now, if you do that, what's the position? Well, what's the position in employment law, in contract law? You've terminated your own contract yourself, and you may have done it by express words of resignation. You might have sent in a resignation letter, or you might simply have resigned at what's called an implied resignation by conduct, just by being persistently absent. So if you don't come into work for days on end, weeks on end, and the company writes to your home and rings you up, where are you? You just don't reply, you don't come back. After a time, the company is entitled to consider you to have resigned. It's an implied resignation by conduct. You see? Or they might see you posting on Facebook, you're living in France now. You think, what? What's all this about being in France? And they can see you and, well, you have effectively resigned from the company. You didn't expressly resign, you just went to live in France. Do you see? Well, you have, therefore, effectively implicitly resigned. So if they then said, well, we either accept your express resignation, we see your resignation letter in front of us, we accept your resignation, or they say, we accept your implied resignation. The fact that you've not been in for now for nearly 2 months, we think you've gone. So we're treating you as having resigned. Now how could you turn to Cadbury's and say, no, you're acting wrongly. You promised this chap that he had a job for life and a cottage for life. Do you see? Now which of us would have a problem theologically with Mr. Cadbury over this? Which of us would say, unless we were an absolute ultra shop steward type, who'd argue with Mr. Cadbury? And say, Mr. Cadbury, you're behaving appallingly. All he did was send a letter of resignation, and you're treating it as if it was a letter of resignation. Who would say that? Do you see? We'd say, that's an absurd comment. Mr. Cadbury's done nothing wrong. You've resigned from the company. And it doesn't... Would you say, yes, but this totally breaks what Mr. Cadbury said at the beginning. He said, I had a job for life. You say, yes, of course he said that, but... He didn't mean that you'd have a job for life if you resigned and went to live in France instead. He didn't mean that. He meant if you stay at Bourneville and work at Cadbury's. That's what he means. Do you see? So, does that help? Mm-hmm. Can people see that? Now, we work for someone infinitely more faithful than George Cadbury. God's promises to us are meaningful. They really, really mean something. We have got assurance of salvation. Provided we understand what he means by it, which is if you stay with him, you're absolutely assured. Like I spoke last time about being on the train. You stay on the train, you're all right, you're going there. But you get off the train, you leave Cadbury's, you send a letter of resignation in, or you just don't turn up for work for weeks and months, then you've left Cadbury's. So if you abandon your faith, if you go away from it, if you go away from him, then he will have to eventually treat you as the driver of the train would treat you. He'll drive on without you. He'll treat you as Cadbury's would. They'll just go on without you. Okay. Let's make another point about denying him. We mustn't deny Jesus Christ. If we don't deny him, he will not deny us. But if we deny him, he will deny us. So, the first question to ask is ourselves is, are we saved? If you are saved, then resolve to remain so. Stay firmly rooted in him. Never leave him, and he'll never leave you. Never deny him, and he'll never deny you. But this is the fact. If we deny him, then he will deny us. Let's look at a couple of passages. Matthew 10:32 and 33. 33 says, but whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father. And what does that mean? He's going to deny us before his Father? What does he mean by it? And then in 2 Timothy, Paul says, 2 Timothy 2, 11 and 12, if we endure, we will also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. Now, if you subscribe to an entirely and very exaggeratedly once saved always saved position, you have to ignore verses like this. You have to either ignore them or misunderstand them or explain them away in some way, dodge them, get rid of them somehow. But these are clear statements. And let's look at what was said to King Asa in the Old Testament. This is what one of the prophets was sent by God to tell him in 2 Chronicles 15, 1 and 2. It says, the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa, that's the king, and said to him, hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. Now that's been said by this rather brave prophet to the king. So, the same is true of us. So it's not some new idea that's come in from Paul or somewhere. This has always been the case. God is totally faithful. But if you forsake him, if you abandon him, then you are not with him anymore. So the very same warnings are made in the New Testament as were given to Asa. It's how God has always acted. So the question then is, all right, well, we accept that such warnings are there, but they surely don't apply to us. Maybe they're just only applying to unbelievers. Well, do they? It seems to me undeniable that they apply to us. How could they not? The letter, 2 Timothy, is written to Timothy. This is Paul speaking to him. Jesus is speaking to his disciples. Jesus says, whoever denies me before men. He didn't say, whoever doesn't believe in me at all anyway, whoever didn't believe in me in the first place, and therefore denies me by never having believed in. He didn't say that. He says, whoever denies me. You could be denying him having previously, you know, accepted him. So it is applying to believers. So in the light of that, and in the light of all the other things we've looked at, the conclusion we have to reach is that it's entirely possible for a real Christian to deny Jesus. Otherwise, why warn us of it? It's entirely possible to turn your back on him and therefore to lose your salvation and end up in the lake of fire. Those are the conclusions I am incapable of not reaching. I have to reach those conclusions. But those conclusions are anathema to a once saved, always saved stance. Saying what I've just said is like saying Derry or Londonderry to the wrong person. Do you see? It's totally unacceptable. But it's what the Bible says. So let's look at the question of fearing God, because this is such an important topic that helps you to stay faithful. If you fear him and respect him, it is vastly easier to continue to honour and follow him than if you don't. The fear of the Lord helps to sustain faith. It keeps you away from slipping into sin. It keeps you from compromise. It keeps you from the wrong company. It keeps you from beginning to just take steps in the wrong direction. It keeps you from getting off the train. So if you said, the fear of missing the train, the fear of missing the train keeps you on the train. The fear of missing the train gets you to the platform early. Do you see? The fear of the train going without you means that you don't even dare get off and stretch your legs on the platform. And why? Because of the fear of missing the train. Or the fear of the Lord has the same effect. The fear of the Lord keeps you straight, keeps you on the narrow road. It keeps you on the right way. It keeps you faithful. That's why you need it. It's one of the reasons why you need it. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But also what it is, it's a way of staying faithful. And I was just, the other day I tweeted to a vicar, a woman vicar in the Church of England. And she had, it was when this debate was taking place about the referendum in Ireland about gay marriage. And this vicar had, in England, had tweeted about this and was mocking the Book of Leviticus and what the Book of Leviticus has to say about homosexuality being an abomination. And she was saying what a yawn it is, a yawn, Y-A-W-N, meaning it's boring. She doesn't like it. She's fed up hearing of Leviticus. She doesn't want to hear about it. And she was mocking it. Now, how could you do that if you had the fear of the Lord? So how could anybody mock God's word if you had even an ounce of the fear of the Lord? Now, that woman, I tweeted back to her and warned her about the judgment that's coming. She didn't reply. But you could not do what she did or say what she said if you had any fear of the Lord. She said what she said because she has no fear of God at all. I couldn't insult any part of the Bible. I just wouldn't be able to. I wouldn't want to in the first place, but I wouldn't dare. Do you see? How could you insult God, insult his word? The very fact that you do it indicates that you don't fear him. But if you fear him, you won't do it. So if you have no fear of the Lord, or if you're casual or indifferent to things which God considers precious, or if you ignore his word, you're in grave danger. Because whatever it is that you are becoming, whether it's good or bad, you have a tendency to become more that way. So you'll get more concentrated, more intense in whichever direction you're going in. See? So you've got Got to look at which direction are you going in. If you're drifting away from God, put it right straight away. If there's something wrong, put it right straight away. Because whatever direction you're going in at the moment, whatever you are at the moment, you're likely to become more concentrated in that direction. You're going to become more like that. You're like a glass of Ribena evaporating on a windowsill. Someone's left a glass of Ribena, orange, blackcurrant cordial, in the windowsill on a sunny day, and they go away on holiday, and they come back a week later. What have they got in that glass? They've got like congealed, thick kind of thing at the bottom of the glass that used to be a glass of Ribena, but has evaporated away into just a thick thing. It's become more Ribena-ish than it was. It's become more concentrated than it was. And so as we go on, we'll either become more fearing God or less fearing God. So if we're not fearing God, we'll fear him less. If we're fearing him, we'll fear him more. If we're faithful, we'll get more faithful. If we're unfaithful, we'll get more unfaithful. Whatever it is, it's like if you diverge, if two walkers diverge, and this one is going 2 degrees further east than this one. As the miles go, this one's going due north. This one's going just a couple of degrees east. Now, as they set off, 5 yards in, they look like they're walking alongside each other. And then as the miles go by, they're miles apart. 100 miles later, they'll be perhaps 20 miles apart. Because you become more of whatever it is that you are. Therefore, pay attention to what you are. Now, ask yourself, am I faithful now? Am I unfaithful now? Do I fear the Lord now or don't I? Do I have a strong conscience or don't I? What am I now? I want to become more fearing the Lord. I want to become more faithful now. Get on that path. Take that decision to go due north, not veering. Another point, you can't stand still. You have to travel. This is the thing. You can't just decide to stay where you are. The fact is, we have to travel. And that's why you must choose the direction you're going to go in. Because as you proceed further, you'll either get closer and better to what you should be, or you'll go further away. Because you'll diverge. If you're going the wrong way, you'll diverge, and the distance will get bigger. So, you can't stand still. You have to choose your direction. And you have to choose your direction based upon these warnings. The warnings will help to keep you on the path. That's why they're given. And what does it say in 1 Samuel? It says, "For those who honour me, I will honour, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed." 1 Samuel 2:30. God will respond to you in the same way that you respond to him. If you are faithful to him, if you fear him, if you honour him, he'll honour you. If you do what he says, he'll help you. If you ignore him, if you despise him, if you depart from him, then he'll let you do it. So, rewards at the judgment seat. I'll just mention this because we've done a whole series on the judgment seat, but just for the sake of this tape. If we honour him and hold fast and persevere, and if we bear fruit in our lives, then not only can we have assurance of salvation, we can also be assured that we'll be rewarded. We'll be rewarded at the judgment seat. And Paul spoke of this. He spoke earlier in his life of how he feared losing his inheritance. He feared that he might be found to have worked in vain. But when he wrote 2 Timothy, he was very close to death. He knew he was going to be executed. He knew the end was very near. And he knew then that he was saved and would go to heaven. But he also knew by this stage that he would be rewarded. Perhaps God had given him a special revelation. But he knew death was very soon. And this is what he says. "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. 2 Timothy 4:7-8. And we'll carry on in the next talk.